episode 18, season 2 of The Bad Apples. Here I am back from NAB. NAB is National Association of Broadcasters, a very, very large convention held in Las Vegas, as far as I know, every year. It is, it's a significant conference for people in television, film, radio, media distribution, things like that, because it brings together basically in, I guess, three or four different conference halls, just a variety of international companies and vendors and researchers who are involved in the media racket. I'd never been to NAB. I've been to similar conferences, but never to this one, and this one apparently is sort of the mother of all media conferences. It was huge, much larger than I would have ever expected. And of course, being interested in Linux, I kept an eye out for anyone who might speak that language. And there were quite a few Linux representatives out there, or users of Linux anyway. Predominantly, I found Red Hat all over the place. Not that Red Hat was actually there, but when I came across something running Linux, it was running, a lot of them seemed to be doing Red Hat, or if I asked them about Linux, they would acknowledge that, yeah, some of their systems do run on Linux, and I would ask what kind of Linux, and they would say Red Hat. Some of the companies that were there that I would have, I guess, expected a little bit more Linux from was HP, Hewlett Packard. All of their setup, I'm not really sure why they were there, but it didn't seem like they had anything specific to media creation or media distribution, but they did have computers set up there, and they were all running some form of Windows. So nothing there. And none of the representatives seemed to really know much about Linux. So whatever that means. One of the companies that I found interesting and got an interview with was SGI. Actually, I didn't speak with anyone from SGI. I spoke with someone from a company that works with SGI. And let's talk to him for a minute.
I'm at the SGI booth, but I'm speaking with LSI's Larry Ekdahl. And Larry is a storage guy, is that right?
That's correct. Yep.
So you were saying that LSI, I guess, is the manufacturer of a lot of storage that other people will OEM and put their brand on?
LSI is the manufacturer of storage that we OEM to other companies, and SGI is one of our partners that uses our storage.
Gotcha. So SGI these days, you were saying, does a lot of stuff with, well, I mean, obviously they're big in the server space. They're servers, and they're doing a lot of image processing and image capturing for, like, government and scientific organizations?
That's correct, and of course that's a lot of storage, so we're a storage partner with them, but they do a lot of satellite capture and capturing large amounts of data, and then putting it out so it can be useful, so it can be analyzed and taken off into other processing for analysis and whatever. So
you're talking about a lot of image rendering oftentimes.
That's correct. Yeah.
What kind of chips are in the SGI units these days?
And SGI uses Intel chips in their servers, all the Intel Itanium and Xeon processors. They used to use MIPS chip in the older IRIX machine.
So IRIX, I know, ran some kind of Unix. SGIs these days, you've seen a lot of Linux usage, is that right?
That's correct. In fact, they use Linux and Red Hat Linux and SUSE Linux, and then they build a Pro Pack that goes on top of that to deal with some of the high-performance hardware that goes with their servers.
Very cool. What are some of the issues that you run into when you're dealing with like large amounts of storage? Like, I guess you probably move it back and forth between servers or something. Or I mean, what do you deal with, I guess, on an everyday basis?
Well, you have to figure out how much storage, how fast you want to move it, how many LUNs you're going to use, or LUNs being like disks, how many disks you're going to need to, and how many parallel streams you're going to have to run for the data, and then making sure that it gets there, that it's, and then sometimes after it's saved, you might want to migrate it off to cheaper storage. So it might be fiber channel storage, and then the cheaper storage will be SATA, and you can automatically migrate it then to SATA storage for longer, long-term storage.
How long do a lot of the organizations that you deal with, I mean, I don't know what kind of organizations you deal with, but like, what's a typical life cycle of storage? Like, how far back in time do they want to be able to go?
It all depends on the type of data that it is. So, you know, with the Sarbanes-Oxley stuff, you got to keep it for a long time, and then other types of storage, you get rid of it. So a lot of people will, you know, they don't differentiate, they just save everything and then end up saving it for a long time. So if you differentiate, then some things get saved a long time, and some things get saved three years or 5 years or whatever the requirement is. So
it seems like when you're storing data, like when you're doing traditional backup, there must be bits and bytes in there somewhere that are kind of redundant. Is there anything going on to solve that problem?
Well, in the industry now, there's something called deduplication, and that's exactly what it tries to do, is take out the duplicates and make it the storage more efficient, especially secondary storage. And as they move the data across, they take out all the duplicate data. And then if you had to restore it again, it would be able to build that back in again. It's a lot like a compression technique.
Very cool. Do you ever run into any other Linuxes when just in your everyday job?
Oh, yeah. Gentoo being one of them, and just a variety. People are always trying to, especially lower-cost appliance manufacturers will try to use a basic Linux that doesn't have a lot of things in it that, you know, that they can just tone down to exactly what they want for it. So,
cool. You ever run into any Slackware?
I haven't seen Slackware, actually.
Ah. Do you run Linux at home?
Yeah, I have a Linux server at home. But because I'm on the marketing and, you know, work with sales a lot, I end up with a lot of Microsoft stuff.
Well, we all feel your pain, probably. Everyone has to do it. But yeah, cool. What distro do you do? What kind of Linux do you run?
I run Red Hat.
Cool. Very cool. Thanks a lot, Larry. It was a pleasure talking to you.
You're welcome.
Another guy I came across worked for Thomson, and Thomson is a very, very large company. It's actually based in France, which I was not aware of. But they own companies like Grass Valley, and they own, which is a they make hardware primarily for like TV. When I've used them, it was at a TV station that I worked at, used to bring in compressed signals from outside and you know, to uncompress them as much as they would be decompressed and get them ready for airing. They make sort of hardware-based solutions for that kind of thing. They also, Thomson also owns, as far as I can tell, RCA, which I'm sure you know from just consumer electronics. But Thomson apparently has a research arm, which is what this guy was with, and he was talking a lot about media distribution on a business level. Concerned with like how ISPs are going to be able to get us media that we're requesting once such systems are in place. I mean, I know Netflix is already distributing certain movies via streaming to Windows, operating systems only, unfortunately. But they are doing that kind of thing where they're trying to actually send a complete movie down to you so that you can see it without ever having to receive the DVD in the mail. So this kind of idea of distributing entire DVDs, not as compressed as something you would, for instance, let's say BitTorrent, if it was an independent, freely distributable movie, of course, they tend to be quite compressed. So how to get less compressed content out to people consistently with a consistent stream, rather than having you rely on, you know, letting it download overnight, you know, something a little bit more immediate than that. So he's talking a lot about legal and sort of business-approved peer-to-peer networking, managed peer-to-peer networking, so that when someone is downloading a file from a central location, if there are other people in that area downloading that file, they can also download or share the information with each other to speed things up. Now, this is, I mean, it's basically managed BitTorrenting, I suppose, in a way. But the idea that intrigued me, or the fact that intrigued me, was that his research lab was built on Linux. And so I spoke to him about what he was doing.
I'm sitting with Vincent from Thomson, which is a company pretty well known in the post-production world for streaming technologies, and turns out they have a really cool researching arm. And Vincent, what's the idea behind this networking, I guess, distributed distribution?
The main idea is to propose a new kind of architecture. I mean, today what you need is a lot of server, because you need redundancy and you need bandwidth, but other things cost you a lot of money. So what our idea is to create nano data centers in which, and during the night, for example, we put contents on the boxes, so that when a customer wants to see the boxes, it just contact his neighbor and download contents.
Okay, so it's basically peer-to-peer, legal peer-to-peer movie sharing.
It's managed peer-to-peer. In fact, ISPs have a control of the network, so they do what we want of the network. For example, they increase bandwidth for the kind of movie or whatever you want.
So the market, or the, I guess the audience for this would be like an ISP or maybe a Blockbuster video, like online rental or something?
Yes, the two customers who are interested by your ideas are many ISP, because they can optimize the bandwidth use, and the movie creator, because it's a new way to make content delivery.
Right, okay, cool. So right now it's in research phase, and I see these boxes and computers. What's the advantage to this? Like, if I unplug one of these, are you saying that the media will just keep streaming, basically?
Main advantages for the customer is that you have a very good quality of service. For example, as you can see, if your neighbor box fails, it doesn't matter, because you receive data from another boxes. And from the fact that we create virtual machine, a piece of software can crash. It's not a problem, because you don't affect the other piece of software.
So each server is basically a virtual machine, so that if one virtual machine dies, you have backup virtual machines. Is that correct? Or no, it's because the machine hosting the virtual machine is still running. That's why.
Yeah. So the main idea for a virtual machine is that in your for ISP, for each service you create a virtual machine. And so you don't need to be sure that your software is bug-free, because if your virtual machine crashes, it doesn't matter. You just have to reboot it. But today it's not the same. You have ISP, must be sure to have a very good software before sending it to the boxes. And it takes, so I tell you, on between 1 and 2 years to create a new service.
Right. Cool. And so are these the units that you'll be selling to the ISPs, or are these just like demos for yourself?
I work for research, so for a moment it's not a product we sell. It's just we are a kind of pioneer. You try to look for new services, new way of doing that. And after we work with our team inside Thomson to say, okay, we have find that, we find it interesting, and it's worth to work on it and to create a product.
Cool. And what distributions of Linux are you usually running in your lab or at home or whatever?
That's a personal question, but personally I like Debian and Ubuntu because they are very easy to manage, and Ubuntu is cool because you have a proprietary firmware, which is not the case of Debian, and they are very stable. So when you work with Linux and you don't want a very stable distribution to avoid the problem. And
all right, well, thanks for talking to me, Vincent, and great work. Alina at the Autodesk booth. Autodesk manufactures a couple of different high-end production software packages that are coupled with, typically coupled with hardware as well. So the one that you're going to recognize probably is Maya, which is the 3D modeling program. That actually can work with a variety of different platforms, Linux included. There are even more specialized packages, somewhat related to Maya, but not necessarily. They're independent of it. There's Flame, which is what's called a compositing program. So that would, for instance, take King Kong, maybe that you've rendered in Maya, and place King Kong very realistically in footage that you've actually gone out and acquired in real life. So King Kong doesn't exist, except in Maya, along with, you know, New York City landscape, which does exist in real life. Take them both into Flame, put them together, produce all kinds of cool effects, and people, hopefully, in the audience will believe that they're actually together. Smoke is another application. If you could imagine, if you've ever seen Final Cut Pro or something similar to it, even Avid, plus something like After Effects or Motion, all rolled into one, that would begin to touch what Smoke could do. It's a fantastic application, just an editor's dream. It's just really, really a nice application. Now, Flame and Smoke are both dependent upon hardware, so they've got a DSP style, basically an extra processor dedicated to the functionality that they have as programs. So it's about a $75,000 price tag for this kind of system. The reason I'm talking about this at all is that they both run, all three of these, Maya, Flame, Smoke, and a couple of other Autodesk programs, run on Linux. And what was really interesting to me was that Alina, who was demonstrating Smoke, was saying that there's been a really big move over to Linux in the post houses. Now, post houses have used Linux for quite some time. If you read about a lot of the animated features, most of them, I think, were done on Linux because they have the flexibility. Well, you know why they're using Linux, because it's a great operating system, right? So they're using Linux. They're writing their own apps for their workflow, and they're also using these robust post-production programs running on, as well, Linux. And of course, it's very notable that the Apple software Shake, which they purchased from some other company, was going to be an Apple product, and yet, because the post houses need Shake to run on Linux, Apple actually continued, even after they purchased Shake, to offer Shake for Linux. Something interesting about that, of course, is that while they were offering their Shake package for Mac for $500, they were charging the Linux
version, they were charging $5,000. Just an interesting thing. Just going to kind of mention it, you know. Could be anything. That doesn't mean anything. Just throwing it out there. But anyway, Alina is saying that there has been a noticeable move where from customers who were using Windows to actually switching over to Linux, simply because the performance was better, obviously the stability was better, flexibility was better, etc. And this was interesting to me because Alina didn't know necessarily Linux from anything else. She was simply talking from a standpoint of a smoke artist, very talented, skillful artist with these programs, especially Smoke. That was her specialty. And she was simply speaking from her knowledge of what customers were doing. So it was interesting to hear that. I was glad when Alina went out to the desktop because I was curious as to what kind of Linux it was running, and it was running Red Hat. So, yet again, it's Red Hat. And if you look at the Smoke manual, all of their installation instructions are for Red Hat. So it's apparently assumed that you're running, you know, a Red Hat style system, which is interesting to me. I don't know why that would be, except that I guess maybe Red Hat got into the server space earlier or more strongly than Debian. I'm not sure. I don't have the history behind me to really understand why that is, but it was interesting. The problem is that I lost the interview with Alina. My microphone wasn't turned on, so I can't tell you. She can't tell you in her own words what Smoke is, or that customers are switching to Linux, or really anything else, because it's gone. But that's what she said. And she was a very skilled artist. It was cool to watch her work. She was using a Wacom tablet, or Wacom, or however you say it, the big stylus tablet thing. She was using that exclusively, didn't touch the mouse at all. She keyboard and stylus, which was interesting to me. And she was just flying through this program. It was very impressive to see. Very cool. The last thing this week I've got for you is a little software package that I think might be a bit obscure. Certainly I just found out about it fairly recently. So in the sad, sad, lonely world, tyrannical world of proprietary software, if you wanted to explore your creative side and try your hand at writing a screenplay or an audio play or anything that has a standardized format, you had basically four options. And these were important and significant options because there's literally, you know, you've probably seen on the internet at least a screenplay written out, and if you've seen a real screenplay, you've seen that they have a very specific format, and in fact it's very, very specific down to the, you know, the margin width and everything like that, and they do it this way so that they can estimate how long a scene will take, and so it needs a certain amount of white space in it, and it needs to be formatted a certain way so that their averaging techniques can actually work. So if you wanted to do that, you had basically four choices. The most popular one, I guess, was Final Draft. Final Draft is kind of the consumer-level screenplay writing software. It goes for something like $250, which is ridiculous, because all it does is it just auto-formats your text, you know, so that if you type something all in capital letters, it kind of recognizes that that's a character's name, and it places it, you know, 4.25 inches in, or whatever the exact measurement is. And then you hit return, and it understands that the next line is going to be dialogue, so it reverts to normal capitalization, and it'll do that. And you hit return again, and it knows that what's coming next is going to be the next character's name, so it goes up to caps again, and again indents it correctly. So that kind of functionality, I mean, it saves you obviously a lot of time, because you don't have to sit there and tab over or set all your tab settings yourself. So it's really, really nice functionality, but $250 for a slightly beefed up word processor seems a little bit extreme. And to make matters worse, with Final Draft, which is what I used to use, you had a certain, you know, there's the whole licensing thing. And if you load it, you have to call the company to activate your license. And you can only load it onto 3 computers. And if something should happen to that computer, there's a strong chance that that license is going to go away with that computer. It's always like this game of calling them up and saying, well, this computer just died on me, or this hard drive died, and it's, you know, I can't deactivate this computer, but I need to activate it again on my new computer, you know. And it was just this whole issue that you were always dealing with. It was the pits. The other choice was Movie Magic Screenwriter, which was more of the professional level of Final Draft, which is interesting because basically it had the same functionality, except that it also kind of tied in with some scheduling and budgeting software that Movie Magic also made. This was a very expensive software. The whole production suite was just really expensive. Very few people actually had it. It was more something for an assistant director or a producer who literally, you know, their bread and butter was taking scripts and breaking them down and planning out how they were going to be shot and budgeting them out and stuff like that. Third option, which was only for the poorest of the poor, was someone released a macro set for Microsoft Office that would approximate what Final Draft or Screenwriter would do. And that was free, but it was the pits, because you were using Office. It didn't work correctly. It just wasn't as fluid as either of the other two. And then, of course, the fourth option, which no one ever did, is just format it yourself. Set your own tab settings and tab over and make sure that you've got everything aligned correctly. No one ever did that. That's ridiculous. So the great thing is that there's a free and open source alternative to all of these disastrous software packages. And it's called Celtx, C-E-L-T-X. You can find it at Celtx.com. That's C-E-L-T-X. I have no idea why they call it that. But what it is basically a screenwriting software rolled up with really sort of a pre-production package. This is very, very significant. If you have an idea for a screenplay and want to get it down, or if you're interested in that area and want to make that something that you do all the time, this is something that obviously runs on Linux. It also runs on the other operating systems, the other big ones, and it's a really cool software. It does the exact same thing as, for instance, Final Draft. I mean, it will detect when you're writing dialogue. You use the tab key a lot, so you'll tab over to get into a character mode. It does the capitalization for you. Hit return, now you're in dialogue. It, again, takes care of the settings, the margin settings, and the capitalization. To get out of character dialogue, you hit the tab again, and it goes into action mode, so that now you're writing what would be called a screen direction, where you're actually describing what the character is doing. You know, Klaatu goes to the chair, sits down, starts recording, drinks a cup of coffee. All that kind of thing that's not dialogue, it's just normal, sort of normal margin settings, normal capitalization. You can also, which is very cool, after you've written the entire screenplay, a lot of times you'll find the need to move scenes around. You know, you realize that you had Klaatu drinking his cup of coffee before he starts recording, and you think to yourself, well, really, that should come a lot later. That should be something, you know, towards the end of the film. So you can go out into an index card view, and the index card view will detect the scenes and gives you kind of a broad overview of your script, and now you can drag those around and have them in different places, so you can really reorganize the entire script in this way. Or you can just use it as a good broad overview when you're looking at what you're going to have to shoot in the end. There are also modes to help you with, you know, breaking the script down so that you know what kind of props you're going to need to buy, how many characters you've got. There are things to help you schedule the film, so that if you know you have 5 scenes in one apartment, then you know that you'll need that apartment for, you know, I don't know, whatever, 5 days. And then you'll need another set for another 5 days. You know, you can kind of take a look at what you've written and see what kind of requirements it's going to take for you to actually go out and make that movie. So this is all functionality that would at least cost you $250, if not substantially more. It's a great little software package. It's interesting because it's based on Mozilla code, and it's released under the Mozilla license. So it's free and open source. It's a lot more trouble, for the record, to compile this from source than it is worth. They do have a generic binary build for Linux that you can download. I suggest, and they also have I'm pretty sure they have Debian and RPM packages too. I was just using it on my Slackware system, and compiling Mozilla I never realized was so complex. It's just got a lot of different options and a lot of specific dependencies that I just was very surprised that I would need them all. And it was a little bit difficult because I didn't really want to sit there and read all the documentation to figure out exactly what I needed to include in when I was compiling. And you have to enable different applications because obviously the Mozilla suite includes Firefox and Sunbird and you know, all these Sea Monkey and all the whole suite. You don't need to enable all that. You just need to enable Celtx to be built. But then I ran into issues of what Celtx required. You know, I spent a good evening or two trying to figure that out before I realized there was an easier way and just took the generic binary build that they provided on their site, dropped that into /user/local directory, add it to whatever application menu you want to. In KDE, you just go to, there's a menu editor in there. You can just add the command to your menu editor, give it whatever icon you want, and you're good to go. So it's much easier to do that way. Or if you're on some other system that actually has like a .deb or an RPM, you can do that too. They provide those. But it's definitely something to check out if you're either into making movies or you're trying to, or you just want to try it out. Go for Celtx. It's a really great software. It's very, very impressive. It's a pleasure to use. It's really quite seamless. If you're used to the proprietary alternatives, this is the way to go. Well, it looks like we've come to the end of the Bad Apples, episode 18. If you need to email me, it's gort.klaatu@gmail.com. That is gort.klaatu@gmail.com. Be sure to stop by the website if you want. I don't have a whole lot there right now. No screen, no wallpapers lately. Been very busy with other projects. But there are some links on the side of the page now and stuff like that. Music was done by Fat Chance Lester. And again, thanks to everyone for listening.